Last Wednesday evening, I spoke to the parents of those children who next spring will receive for the first time God's forgiveness in the sacrament of penance and Holy Communion. Earlier that day, I was in my study preparing for the meeting with parents, thinking about these delightful things, when I got word of a tragedy unfolding just a few miles from here, in Town Hall. You know the outline of the tragedy. A 14-year-old boy murdered his own father, and then drove a few miles away to an elementary school, crashing onto the playground in a truck, where he leaped out and shot three people, a teacher and two first-grade boys, one of whom died yesterday. This one stings more than the others that we read about because it is next door. But such things happen everywhere, constantly. In the last week, more than 100 children were killed in Aleppo by fighting so savage that even the law of the jungle does not apply. Not a week goes by without a story of another man brandishing a weapon, killed by the police. 2 days after the tragedy in Townville, the Greenville Sheriff's Department had to kill a man in self-defense who was running through the woods with a gun in his hand. Over and over and over, we are reminded of what the prophet Habakkuk knew. How long, O Lord? I cry for help, but you do not listen. I cry out to you, violence, but you do not intervene. Why do you let me see ruin? Why must I look at misery? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and clamorous discord. We do not yet know why that troubled 14-year-old boy murdered his father and unleashed violence on a school playground. Not specifically, but I do know this. That and every other example of violence in human history is finally attributable to the mysterium iniquitatis, the mystery of lawlessness, which came into the world through our first parents and their rebellion against God's eternal plan, against our Father's law of love. We come into the world already entwined with the mystery of lawlessness. It is a part of every human life. And even when it doesn't lead in an individual case to explosions of violence, there is always rebellion, refusal to serve the Lord, a selfish turning in that alienates us from others. This is the mystery of lawlessness. Many solutions are offered to the misery, strife, and discord that flow from the mystery of lawlessness. Education, it is said. Economic prosperity. Political liberty. Each of these things contributes in some way, yes, to the human dignity of each person. But none of those things can remove from the human heart the rule of the mystery of lawlessness. Even well-educated, wealthy, and powerful people are afflicted by the mystery of lawlessness. In fact, they perhaps more than any. The only remedy for the mystery of lawlessness, for the mysterium iniquitatis, is the mysterium paschale, the paschal mystery of the suffering, death, and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. For the last several weeks, we've been reading from the Gospel of St. Luke. Luke's Gospel has 24 chapters, and of those, 10 are dedicated to what is usually called the journey to Jerusalem. It's the heart of Luke's telling of the story of the ministry of the Lord Jesus, from the middle of chapter 9 to the middle of chapter 19. Jesus is traveling from Galilee to Jerusalem. Along the way, he's accompanied by the 12 apostles and by others who travel with them. The teaching, as Luke presents it, is very often in response to questions posed to him by the 12 or by those they encounter on the way, chiefly the Pharisees. The journey to Jerusalem opens with the apostles asking the Lord Jesus to teach them how to pray, and he gives them the Our Father. Today we hear them ask another question, or pose this request. The apostles said to the Lord, "Increase our faith." And he answers them with two sayings, reminiscent of the wisdom tradition of the Old Testament. Two sayings about faith. One concerns a mustard seed, other servants who've worked all day and must still tend to the table of their master before they themselves are permitted to eat. The point of these two sayings is this: authentic faith, the theological virtue of faith, which is a free and unmerited gift, has the power to change lives, even in dramatic ways, and cannot be purchased, discovered, acquired in any way other than receiving it as a free gift. If you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you would say to this mulberry tree, "Be uprooted and planted in the sea," and it would obey. Do we really believe that faith can change our lives in this way? Both of these sayings, of course, are hyperbole, an exaggeration for effect to drive home the point. By the gift of saving faith, which we receive first in our baptism, we are offered everlasting life. And more than that, even now in this life, we are offered the ability to live according to the law of love as a new creation. How long, O Lord? Anyone who has ever experienced the power of the mystery of lawlessness in their lives naturally cries out, "How long, O Lord? Why do you let me see ruin?" It's easy to imagine young Jacob's parents crying out in just this way as they prepare to bury a 6-year-old boy, gunned down by a 14-year-old boy on the playground. "How long, O Lord?" But if we have received the gift of saving faith, then already we participate in the Paschal mystery, which is the answer to the mystery of lawlessness. Then the Lord answered Habakkuk and said, write down the vision clearly upon the tablets so that one can read it readily. For the vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and will not delay. Habakkuk had to look forward to a horizon he could not see. Now we look back to Calvary, to the fulfillment of the promise and the vision. To the man of peace, who took upon himself the entire mystery of lawlessness and allowed it to be nailed to the cross in his own flesh. That's the answer. But it does not relieve us from the hard work of living according to the grace of faith. That's the point about these hardworking servants who've been in the field sweating, stinking, starving. They come into the house. They don't even have time to wash their face, let alone to sit down and enjoy the meal. No, they have to wait upon the master. And when it's all done, what are they to say? We are unprofitable servants. We have done what we were obliged to do. We are not relieved by the grace of faith from living an authentic human life with all of its joys and sorrows. Yes, even as we contend with the mystery of lawlessness in our own hearts and in the hearts of others. But even after we receive the gift of faith, which can change lives, which can change our lives, even after we receive that gift, we must be careful custodians of it. We often hear the expression that someone lost his faith. Faith is not lost in the way that you might casually put your keys down and forget where you laid them. Faith is deliberately walked away from. It's a breakup. We choose to walk away from our faith every time we deliberately choose sin. Which is why Paul had to write to Timothy, beloved, I remind you to stir into flame the gift of God that you have through the imposition of my hands. He refers here to the grace of Timothy's ordination, as we would say now. Paul made him a minister of word and sacrament, a bishop of Christ and the church. But these words could just as easily apply to the grace of our baptism. Stir into flame the gift of God, for God did not give us a spirit of cowardice, but rather of power and love and self-control. We must be careful stewards of the gift of faith. And we are stewards every time we refuse to put our faith aside. Every time we resolve to bear witness to the truth, to live the grace of the new creation. Even when it is costly, especially when it is costly. It would be foolish to expect anyone, including disciples of Jesus Christ, to look the mystery of iniquity in the face and not cry out, how long, O Lord? How long? But when we do that, let us also remember, always and everywhere, to add, increase our faith.